everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is episode number 127. Oh. And we're going to talk about a little-known author named George R.R. Martin. But we're not going to talk about A Song of Ice and Fire. We're going to talk about Tough Voyaging. Tough is spelled T-U-F. Tough Voyaging, a collection of stories about a fellow named Haviland Tough that was written mostly in the 1980s.
Yeah, this is, I guess, what they call a fix-up novel, where they collected the stories and then he wrote a few extra stories to bridge certain gaps and kind of provide an overall arc for the character, which I thought was, it works perfectly in this book.
Mm-hmm. It definitely does.
Yeah, and I've never read one of those long books that have gone to the Game of Thrones. Or he likes to write a lot of long books, but
yes, yes.
I have tried his short stories just to see what his writing was like, and I really like it. So I was really pleased to find this collection, and I just fell in love with this character, Haviland Tough.
Yeah, so. He's got a really interesting career, George R. R. Martin, because he was really active in the late 70s and 80s,
mm-hmm.
winning awards for mostly his short fiction. In fact, I don't think he won anything for a novel, but he wrote some incredible short fiction. Sand Kings.
Did he write that Cross and Dragon?
Yeah, story? The Way of Cross and Dragon.
That is a great short story or novella. I'm not sure which.
Right. And then he disappeared mostly from fiction because he was in television and he was doing like Twilight Zone episodes and had something to do with Beauty and the Beast, the TV series.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then got like a second career in novels with The Song of Ice and Fire, which led right back into TV. So now, of course, you know, with the with the Game of Thrones TV series, which is extremely popular. But, you know, so people know him as this big fantasy writer. But Tough Voyaging is science fiction.
Yeah,
well, so he's flying around in space.
He's also done quite a few anthologies, edited quite a few anthologies of different subjects.
Right.
And you'll see his name on those a lot.
Yeah, one thing I noticed is that they're doing a really nice audio series of stories that he's edited called Wild Cards.
Have you seen those? I've read a few of those. That's an interesting concept.
And they're
different
authors. Yeah, and a whole bunch of different authors, and it seems like a superhero world. I don't know too much about it, but
I vaguely remember it, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're editing or making nice audio versions of those.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, multiple readers. That are all excellent.
To go with authors, I guess. Yeah, that makes sense.
You bet. So, good stuff. But I enjoyed this immensely. It was fun.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah, I was reading it and thinking, you know, I really like 1980s science fiction. There's this quality about it that I think has left. And I've thought a lot about, you know, what that quality is. But, you know, one of the elements, I'm convinced, is optimism. That people tended to write, you know, and there's always exceptions. But I think that people tended to write futures that you might want to live in,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the stories would take place in these futures. Whether the stories were things you'd want to go through or not is a different question, but the future that existed was a place or something that was, you know, at least somewhat positive, that, you know, hey, we could see ourselves living in that future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think nowadays, again, there's always exceptions, but I think nowadays we see so many wastelands and environmental disasters and you know, zombie apocalypses, and you know, I can't think of Nothing leaps to mind, although I'm not super well read in what's current.
Well, the other thing I think...
Nothing's leaping to mind that's positive. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the other thing you find in a lot of today's stories is a lack of focus sometimes. I feel like a lot of it is, I don't know. It's, you know, these stories, they get told, they have a point, and maybe it's because they're short stories. I haven't read his novels, which are huge, so those may meander more, or they may just have so many threads. But a lot of today's stories seem to kind of get in there, and then they wander around, and they think about stuff, and they worry about things, and eventually something happens. And I think that might be a postmodern style of writing also. Hmm. Now, and don't jump on me, people. There's something I read that made me think that. But it's, you know, it's a reaction to whatever the previous kind of writing was. And I don't like it. Hmm. I want a story to be told to me, not just meandered through. Kind of like, I think that was part of my problem with the Joe Walton book we read.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was a lot of thinking about her favorite books and this and that, and there was romance and some things happened. But, you know, you could have put most of that stuff into a novella if you'd have trimmed out all her worrying about this and that and trips to the library. And you know, it's okay, but I like a more tightly told story, I think.
Yeah.
So
understood. Yeah, and I did like that book. Among others.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
so many did.
I can't argue with you. It's, there's just this quality. It made me think a lot about other 1980s stuff. Because, you know, it's also the time in which I really started to read science fiction in earnest, you know. So there's also that aspect of it for me.
Well, and to me, it even harkens back earlier than that because I would have said, oh, it's kind of like maybe Heinlein or something. You have problems, you solve them, you see exotic worlds on the way, and you get to know Tuff, who is a very likable person and maybe the only constantly reliable person other than this other character who we'll talk about later called Tolly Moon.
Yep.
And so you're usually on Tuff's side. I'm not always on his side, but I don't always know what I would do otherwise, the way the stories are set up. So... it's continually looking at this moral choices in the universe that he's in. The essential part of the story is he's a trader. He's a merchant. And his ship is hired by a group of, I guess they're mercenary / adventurers who have found out that there's a big ship, a huge, huge ship called an Ark it was a warship. For biological warfare from, you know, the ancient times. And there were none left, but we found one. And so they're going to go take it over and sell it or use it themselves and make a ton of money. And I don't want to spoil anything, but Tuff winds up with the ship. And you kind of expect that.
Yeah, and that's early on. Yeah, it's important to the rest of it.
Very first story setting everything up. And so what happens is as he goes around earning his living – you see him combining his merchant qualities, which I never thought about it until now. That really means he has to know what somebody's problem is and be able to cater to it in order to sell them something. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's doing through this whole book is they'll say, we've got this environmental thing we need or animals or something. And he'll go and try to figure out how to solve it. And so you see him going from place to place. And at the same time, there's this overarching story that is this one place he keeps coming back to. And we see their problems progressing. As he keeps solving their problems, what happens next based on how they react to what he's done?
That's right. That's right. And one of the things that is so wonderful about it is the character of Haviland Tuff.
Oh yeah,
he is something else. His ship is called the Cornucopia of Excellent Goods at Low Prices.
Yes,
and just the way that he speaks and the way that he acts, he's an unforgettable. He's really a big guy. He's bald. He's very pale, and he just speaks in this manner that is really emotionless and sarcastic. And it just also, it makes me laugh sometimes. Go ahead.
I know. He's also got – he's quite logical in how he presents things, even though he's being funny or sarcastic or whatever, because – and I have a little section where early on while they're on their way to find this seed ship, as it's called, he's playing games with the people on board. And one person is complaining. He says, you know, I use these tactics – Tuff's counter thrust was completely wrong under the circumstances. If the rules had been written properly, it ought to have been routed, and Tuff has beat him every time. Indeed, said Haviland Tuff. You have the advantage of me, sir. You, after all, have the good fortune to be a military historian, and I am merely a humble trader. I lack your familiarity with the great campaigns of history. How fortunate for me that thus far the deficiencies of the game itself and my extraordinary fortune have conspired to make up for my ignorance. Still, I would welcome the opportunity to strengthen my grasp of military principles. If you would care to essay the game once again, I will carefully study your subtle strategy so that I might in future incorporate a sounder, more authentic approach in my own poor play. And everybody around is just cracking up because he's won every single one. And that's so right. He just turns the guy's argument against him.
Absolutely. It's just too funny. It makes me chuckle. And then you have Tuff's cat.
Yes.
He's always got cats around. And cats are rare. To most people he encounters, they're a novelty, you know, because they haven't seen them before.
Yes.
So I love that. I love that. And, the first story was much different than the rest, because the first story is the setup story, and it's called The Plague Star. And, can we get into details? Do we need to say more?
Yeah, let's go ahead, since I've kind of given a little away anyhow, but I definitely, the first story was my favorite.
Okay. Yeah, and it's notably different. It's notably different.
Mm-hmm.
If I was pressed, I would have to say one of the Suthlum stories, maybe the first one, if I had to pick one. Loaves and Fishes,
that's a great one also.
I really genuinely enjoyed every single one of them. I didn't feel like any of them was weak. But Loaves and Fishes, that's good stuff. But the first story, The Plague Star, was different from the others because he's got this group of people. So I'm going to go ahead and get into details now.
Spoilers.
So they find this ark, which again is thousands of years old, or 1,000 years old. I can't remember how old, but it's old. And whoever owned the thing is gone. But it's just in orbit around this planet, in a really crazy orbit. But they get on there, and then they immediately start fighting over the thing.
Yeah.
And Tuff is, just how he acts and everything. Everybody else is, like, knocking each other off. And Tuff is in there trying to figure out how things work.
He's in there trying to clone his cat, which was caught in an environmental firestorm of something, and so it died, but he got a little of the cell tissue, so he's just trying to figure out the cloning bats.
Yeah, he wants to clone the cat. So what this ship is, the Ark, it is a biological ship, not meaning that it's made of biological stuff, but the whole purpose of it is it is biological warfare.
Oh my gosh.
So there's monsters and things and vats to clone things. He later calls himself an ecological engineer because it was the ecological engineering corps of the Federal Empire this ship, and they would use it to wage war, so they could come up with a plague and release it on a planet, or they could come up with a giant monster and release that on the planet.
Yeah, and it tells you how far ago. I mean, Earth is. if anything, a legend.
Yeah.
And so there's one point where he's reading labels from the vats and things are kind of moving around in the vats. And he's like, Tyrannosaurus Rex. Huh, don't know what that is. Later it gets released. We all know what it is. Oh, but it's just... Yeah.
It's too funny. And it reminded me just a touch of the latest Star Wars movie. Again, you know, this book was written in the 80s, but in the latest Star Wars movie, there was some scenes with giant creatures running around in a thing. And this arc is huge. It's like, I think they said it was like 30 kilometers long. It's just massive. And Tuff ends up at the end of the first story being the lone person on it. And, you know, you just imagine all these problems that he's having, but he's just got this attitude like, hey, I'm going to go get this fixed. It used to have 200 people on it, but I need to be able to run it with just me from this room because of inconvenience. It's just inconvenient. Yes. And so he goes to this planet called Suthlem. I don't know how to pronounce it. S apostrophe.
Good attempt.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Suthlem, and he wants them to fix it. There's certain things that don't work and other things that he wants changed. And he wants them to do all that. And then that changes right there for the rest of the book. He is the owner or the captain, whatever you want to call it, of the Ark. And he's going from planet to planet solving problems. And I love those stories. Absolutely terrific.
Those were great because not only do you see the way the problems are solved and the way he thinks versus everyone else, but you see Martin's, George R.R. Martin's inventiveness in the different ecosystems and the different kinds of creatures he's inventing.
Yeah.
And the way, and I think a lot of the time what he's doing also is exploring how people are not paying attention to their environment. I feel like this is, reading it the second time, I was like, wow, this is much more environmental statement book than I realized. I mean, it's not like he's pounding you over the head with it, but he's commenting on, you know, these people who are like using the creatures to do fight clubs with, essentially, or these people who are not paying attention to their environment. So they're inadvertently, they continually are fighting it. And so it's fighting back. They don't understand what's going on, that there's an intelligent creature. Although me, having read so much Lovecraft, is like, I instantly know what the problem is. Mm-hmm. and then the overarching thing where he keeps coming back to, I can't say the name, and I don't have it written down, Suthlem?
Suthlem, yeah, let's call it that.
Let's just say, is population control.
Yeah.
Because they have a religion that says if they keep having children, as many children as they can, their race will eventually evolve and become either closer to God or God itself. I can't remember, but their mission as a race and their religion is to just evolve as fast as possible, which means always having children. Life is always right. And I read that and went, ouch, Catholic Church. I don't know if that was right of me to feel like that was a jab, but maybe I'm oversensitive, but there was a definite, because of that, and because he keeps coming back to that planet, there was a definite controlling life versus pro-life for humans argument always going on.
Yeah, in those stories, in the Suthlem stories. And three of the, I think there's six, is that right? Yeah, three of the remaining six after the first one are about Suthlem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's always about something's gone wrong with the planet somehow, and it's generally because somebody's been not paying attention or fiddling around where they shouldn't, like the Moses story. And it's not only interesting from the point of view of what the people have done or not paid attention to, but the way that Tuff solves things is one of those fascinating puzzle type stories that also, I know last time I said I felt like he was a trickster, and he's not really a trickster, but he's got some of those elements because he's got this code by which he lives, and he's going to insist that everybody lives up to it. But he has to manipulate them a lot of the time to make them do it.
Yeah, and it's true.
You think that's
right? Yeah, that's where the tricks come in, is that he's basically forcing people into a behavior that he finds acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, due to his moral code, whatever that code, wherever it comes from,
mm-hmm.
He's got it, you know. Like, he doesn't eat meat. You know, he doesn't insist that other people don't eat meat, but he, you know, he won't serve it on his ship or anything. But he, you know, he talks about sustainability and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And, yeah, and he's disgusted when people act incorrectly. And he usually, just says, you know, well, fine, if you're going to do that, then this is what's going to happen. But he says it in such a way that, it's just, yeah, it's laughable. It's funny how he says things, but,
Well, yeah, because it brings up an interesting question, because one of the reasons that I like Tuff, and I think that we find him likable, is in the first story, Rika Dawnstar says he's a stickler for the rules. You know, he believes there's a core set of rules and he's not going to disobey them. And he always just says, well, ma'am, you can't have a game without rules, which is what they're talking about at the time. And she's like, yeah, but I mean for everything. So he uses the rules to solve the problems and then also to get what he wants. And then at the very end, in the last story, Tali Moon says, she had said in one of the other, maybe the second story about the planet, she says, you know, I watched our planetary council talk about this arc, and the power of the arc is so absolute seeming that I watched them become corrupted before my eyes. And I think you're the only incorruptible person I know. So I'm going to help you get out before they try to take it away from you. And then in the last story, she says, I was wrong. I think you are corrupted. And he says, well, and so they start talking about, is he God? And he says, well, I may be God, small g always, because I have this power and I'm going to use it like this, or you don't have to use my power.
Yeah.
And so by him following the rules, he seems to do what he wants. Then where does the idea of corruption come into that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure either. Yeah. Because he's, I don't know, if you define corruption as, you know, against another person's will or something mm-hmm. like that, because he, you know, he's just going to do according to his own will.
Yeah, and his ideas aren't their ideas, yeah, and that's the conflict.
And he's doing godlike things, you know, right. to anybody who's on the planet, what's happening is godlike, you know.
Like, and I generally tended to agree with his goals, so yeah. I didn't have a problem with it. But in the last story, you really do kind of have to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because he's talking about the future of an entire race, and are they allowed to make their own choices, even though they're poor choices? And then he co-opts Tali Moon, because he's like, well, I haven't pushed the button to make this thing happen.
Yeah. That's right.
Makes her choose.
That's right. Yeah, and he's doing, yeah, the most incredible things to the planet. It's like, you know, if you do this, this is going to have to happen, and that's going to have to happen, and because of your behavior, this is temporary, and yeah, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I love that guy. there's one time when he, in the second story, the second Suthlum story, he puts on a disguise because he doesn't want anyone to recognize him. And it was so funny because he's undisguisable. You can't disguise him. And
he's so bigger than everyone on the planet.
So he grabs a ship and he names it the Ferocious Velt Roarer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, yeah, that'll be inconspicuous.
Yeah.
And there's this time where he takes off his beard and goes, aha, I am Tuff. And everybody's like, yeah, we knew. We knew that already, dude.
Well, except for the people who knew him knew it. But the other thing that was funny is you kind of see also this building of legendary stories and myth, because between he's been gone 5 years, maybe.
Yeah.
And so between the first set of adventures he has and the time he comes back, they've done a series of videos or, you know, TV shows and movies and everything about this encounter with him. Right. And he, of course, has not been cast as a gigantic fat guy who's bald and all this stuff. He's been a young, good-looking guy. And there's been a liaison, a romantic liaison with Tully Moon in the shown in the dramas. And so everybody keeps going, well, you can't be him. He looks like this. And he's highly offended. He's like, I don't look like that at all. And we never did this. I want this corrected. Mm-hmm. And she's like, good luck.
Yeah. 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 I love it. Their relationship is awesome too. I like, Tully. Tully is her name, right?
Yeah. Tully, whatever.
Something like that.
T-O-L-L-Y.
Yeah, it's funny. So in the first story, you know, they try to take the Ark because of his power, and he ends up winning that and helping them. But but he owes him a bunch of money. So then he comes back in the second story in disguise to pay them some of the money, and he finds out, oh, we've still got problems. And then in the third story, he arrives and he's immediately surrounded by warships that, because they know exactly who he is.
Yeah.
And they want to arrest him. And they want to take the ship by force. So.
And he's coming back on time to repay his debt.
Exactly.
So they know when they can predict him to be there because he is honorable.
Right. Exactly.
And they've got all their population problems, and as well, you kind of feel like if they'd have done the other recommendations he wanted, he might not have been so hard on him, where he's like, okay, but you can't go around having a zillion children all the time because these resources aren't going to last. So like, all right, they can't make the populace do that stuff. And then even when he provides all these other, I think in the second story, he provides all these other creatures, and this is going to help the food problem again. And, he says, but you've got to let go the special land that you've held aside for your, he calls them like more varied food animals, you know, like they're keeping grazing land for cattle sort of thing.
Yeah.
You've got to just let this kind of animal be there because you need all the land to do this. And they haven't, you know, because the rich people have said, well, we like having variety and we like having these special things. And so he's like, really, you guys haven't done anything I said. No wonder you're starving and people are having gangs and turning to cannibalism and stuff like that. And then they have a problem because no one wants to let them off their planet because they know that they'll just spread like a plague of mice. And so they're surrounded by other planets' starships that have been warring with them to keep them on their planet.
Mm-hmm. You guys stay on your planet.
Yeah.
We don't want all your peoples. Yeah.
Yeah, because when he gets there, he's like, there's the very first visit, he says, well, there's not even any other animals. Oh, you mean vermin? Like, oh, I like how they renamed them. So nobody wants a cat. And he's like, this is a cat. It's not vermin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even in the video movie that they showed, you know, the cat ripped someone's throat out or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it was a monster. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's not human or whatever they are.
Yeah, so that, you know, all three of those Sethem stories made me think about the Catholic Church's stance on life. Population growth. Because here they were in a situation where, you know, hey, if you guys continue to breed, for want of a better word, at this rate, no matter what we do is going to be temporary because you're going to overrun all the food that we come up with, and you're just going to have a problem, you know. So population growth is just a big problem in this case.
Yeah, and you see the conflict of two basic ways of thinking, because even though Tully Moon says, well, you know, I can't remember what they call them, but she says, I believe that you should limit your, you know, families, but I can't dictate this to everybody else.
Yeah, and they say because it's religious, right?
Yeah, because it's religious. And because she also says people have the right to choose, you know, it's for themselves. Other people shouldn't choose for them. And he, at one point, I think it's the second story, he has a different point of view. He just looks at people as a part of the ecology. And he says, An ecosystem might be likened to a great biological machine, perhaps. If this analogy is pursued, humanity must be seen as part of the machine. No doubt an important part, an engine, a key circuit, but in no case apart from the mechanism, as is often fallaciously assumed. Ergo, when one, such as myself, re-engineers an ecology, he must by necessity refit as well the humans who inhabit it. And I think that sums up kind of the two different ways of looking at human beings. You know, are you just going to take the scientific viewpoint of we just fit into this like a machine?
Yeah, we're nothing more than this, right?
Yeah, we're intelligent animals, but we're just a part of the ecosystem. Or do you look at it the way Catholics or even, you know, people of faith do, essentially across all kinds of faith, which is that we're more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we certainly are. And we've never been faced with that kind of thing, right? You know,
In the 80s, they were afraid we would be.
Yeah,
that was a huge concern.
Exactly. It was a huge concern. And we I don't know what we're up to, 7 billion people in the world or something like that. And China has certainly come up against that.
Yeah, but now what you're seeing is now what they worry about is falling population growth, right? It's, you know, we're going to get into negative numbers in Japan and in the industrialized worlds, or countries, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
And so then they worry about it. How can we make people have at least two kids? It's like, yeah, so see the propaganda machine, which I guess for want of a better term, but you know, that social thinking has changed enough that people have kind of reversed this problem without needing this kind of ecological stuff that Tuff would do, but it's still a kind of manipulation of what's proper, what do you do, what's good for everybody.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, all this refugee stuff that's going on with Syria and Germany.
Right.
You know, I'm gonna say this without knowing all the facts, but I recall reading something that said that Germany has a population that's either growing very slowly or is negative. And when they were, and because no one's having kids, right?
Right.
So many of the young people don't want children. So, they said that, you know, when they accept these refugees, it would actually be a good thing for them, population wise.
Right.
Yeah, and I wish I could recall where I read that, but that's kind of a European thing, isn't it? I know it's increasingly American as well, but
They say there's not that problem in America because of the immigration. We're continually having new people come in, and you know, plus I think it's just a healthy thing. You need new ideas, new people. I mean, it's in a sense, without thinking it through, let's just say all that right now. It's in a sense when you're cutting off immigration without, you know, just like shut the walls, shut it down. It's like birth control. You don't know what you're turning away that could be amazing. You know, what kind of people will come in and do great things for us or just by being parts of our community. They don't have to be the next Einstein. Who was an immigrant, by the way, or Wernher von Braun or whoever, but they just by being part of us, they enrich us.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with new people in general. I mean, you know, the children that you bring into the world and everything. I don't know.
Yeah.
I
agree with you on both children and immigrants.
Which is the Catholic way to think. Really.
It is. Yeah. And I think that people get really anxious about immigrants when they're different. And, you know, you've got a culture that seems to be shrinking because of immigration. That's the perception anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that it's valid. But I think that that's why people worry so much. It's like the changing character due to different culture, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Yeah, but people didn't. I mean, the Irish used to be so hated and looked upon.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah.
And there are so many of us, like me, with a lot of Irish heritage. And, you know, I love pizza. It's American. Well, no. So, you know, it's like the first people who got here then wanted to shut the doors behind them.
Absolutely right.
This is my stuff, right?
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because I heard an episode of Freakonomics, which talked to a guy who said there should not be immigration control ever. You should just have open borders. And it blew my mind because I thought, what? Can you do that? And then I was reading, I guess, was it Martin Chuzzlewit? And there, that's how it was then. Dickens has Martin Chuzzlewit come to America to try his fortune. And he just gets off at the dock and heads on in. No paperwork, nothing. Yeah, there you are. And I thought, that's interesting. Would that work? I, you know, because I'm so used to having things shut down. And of course, there are cycles of that in history. When I was reading some book about, what was it like during these various biblical times, the archaeological evidence and how did they dress and everything. And I was stunned to find that when Abram was called to go out to the wilderness in Ur, you had to have a pass signed saying that you could leave. Hmm. It had strict control of all that stuff.
How about that? Yeah.
Yeah. So
fascinating.
Yeah. So people have had these ideas for a really, really long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's been, you know, challenges to the Catholic way of thinking quite a bit through the years. You know, this population thing being one of them. And have you seen any news stories about the Zika virus?
Oh, yeah.
Challenging the Catholic teaching?
Yeah.
I mean, specific articles, you know, that say that.
But and, you should allow condom use. And I'm like, yeah. That what?
Yeah. As if that helps. It's like,
yeah.
You know, it was the same thing with the AIDS epidemic in Africa. And they were saying how horrible the Catholic Church was that we wouldn't hand out condoms. Well, it's like, you know, well, that's not our job. You know, you feel like that's necessary. You find your own people to do that. But the thing is, what you're doing is you are saying, okay, you're going to accept a certain amount of risk. Go ahead and do it, but just use one of these rather than saying, well, if you're monogamous or abstinent, that's your 100% way of stopping it.
For AIDS, yeah.
Right. So,
and the Zika virus, how about going after the mosquitoes?
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Right. Exactly.
But that's just,
you know,
launched,
so they're calling us, you know, unreasonable and we're impervious because we're religious and we're not going to listen to that. But it turns out that it's the right thing to do if you look at it impassionately. You know, so it's funny that you'd have news stories and I remember seeing that specifically, you know, Zika virus challenges Catholic teaching and, you're just like, really, you know, so in this story too, you know, it's kind of the same thing where they're talking about the reproductive practices of this thing. And he set up a very extreme situation where, you know, that this is going on you know, if they continue to do that, if they continue to have as many kids as they can possibly have, that it's not going to work out well for them, you know. But that's not the situation we're on this planet.
No.
So,
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I'm thinking the other thing is that they've got Tuff there who is like God going, I can offer you another way that you wouldn't normally have. And but you have to choose. And, you know, nobody is willing to go the unpleasant route, which is what is the consequence of our actions? Perhaps if we just lived with the consequence of our actions, that also is a way to handle it. And that's what God does a lot of the time, where people will say, why did this horrible thing happen? And then you look back and go, and I'm not talking about a car accident necessarily, but, you know, alcoholics and this and this and this. And it's like, you know, a lot of times God goes, well, you chose this. Let me let you see what happens when you do go this way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've tried to offer you option after option after option, and you're not listening. And that's kind of what I feel like they wind up in the last story, where Tuff is not really like God. He feel like he's more like the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah. Right. Knowledge, I guess. Yeah, but it sets up this science versus religion thing, which is so often really false.
Yeah.
You know, but here in this story, he's made it stark.
Yeah.
You know, which is unhelpful in the long run, right? It's like, you know, because in reality, all of these science versus religion things are really not even true.
Right.
It's like, step back and let's look at it impassionately. And you're going to find out that the religious way that we're putting forth is perfectly valid.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point that you make about the story puts it forward, but it's not really a true dilemma in the way that it's put forth. But it's a funny thing. It's like that the story about the star exploding and killing the population so that you could have the star.
The star by Arthur C. Clarke, right.
Where you read that story and you think, absolutely, it somehow becomes almost as if it was true.
Mm-hmm.
When you consider the variables of, you know, your own personal choices, like what kind of a God is that? Well, that's not even a real
thing. Yeah, it's not even a real thing.
And you're right. This whole comparison isn't a real thing either, but I'm willing to accept it because it's written down in the series of good stories. And you said that thing about this isn't really a true comparison. I'm like, oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like he ripped it from the headlines of starving Africans, which in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
this was what we were worried about.
Right.
You know.
That's true.
Good point. True. Good reality check, Scott. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. You know, not quite the same thing, but we – you know, the assumptions that are made about religion and science. For example, I was at a conference this weekend, LTUE, which was a lot of fun. And I was at a panel, then they were talking about maps and map making and fantasy fiction. And they started talking about history of maps. And there was a fellow who started to talk about Galileo. And you know that it's going downhill from there, right? Because everybody thinks they know what happened. And then he said, Copernicus, who got burned at the stake for what he believed.
What?
I know. And I was like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. He did not, you know, and you think about, you know, okay, well, how many people were burned at the stake for believing that the earth went around the sun? And the answer seems to be none.
I was going to say zero.
Yeah. So, but it's there. It's out there in the public psyche because, I was in a mostly LDS Mormon audience just because of where it was held in Provo, Utah, where BYU is. Most people there are not, you know, educated in Catholicism in any way. But, but my point only is that's out there. You know, we know that people got burned at the stake. We know that Galileo, it was a horrible thing. And we know that the Catholic Church is anti-science. These are the things that are just out there, right? And then you start to make these connections. Well, Copernicus must have got burned at the stake, you know. It's like, there's a perception there, I guess, or a zeitgeist or whatever of incorrect thinking. That is not unique to that environment. I think that's all over the place, created by I'm not sure what, but it's it's there, and it's very unhelpful.
Let me just say, just while we're throwing things out there, Galileo was not only not burned at the stake, he actually was invited to a debate in book form with the current Pope, who was very excited about his ideas, who said, well, I'll argue one side and you argue the other. And Galileo went, cool. And then he unfortunately spent his whole time with a character who he named to make fun of the Pope, picking on him for being stupid and an idiot. And the Pope, you know, was not only no dope, but he kind of had his own pride problem too. And he went, oh, really? Yeah. I don't think so. So, first of all, Galileo was not just, you know, Mr. Nice, meek fellow going, here's my scientific experiment. Exactly, and secondly, exactly. he was under house arrest, which was not a terrible thing.
Yeah. And it was not. Life. And not only that, but the bishop offered him his house.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, he had friends. The problem with the Galileo thing is Galileo was kind of an ass.
Totally.
And he made some enemies among the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm.
And once they got the ear of the Pope, it became a political thing. It was a personal fight mm-hmm. between Galileo and other people, and he made it impossible by doing what you just said. He called a character Simplicio or something like that. Simplicio in this book that he wrote, and Simplicio was holding the Pope's point of view, which made him look like an ignoramus. So he basically forced the hand of these political people.
Opened the door.
Exactly. I mean,
stubborn.
And they did not burn anybody at the stake.
It wasn't even that they said you have to refute your theory. Mm-hmm. It's that please don't just put this out there for everyone. Everybody needs time to adjust to this, especially the man in the streets. And he was like, oh, I don't think so.
Yeah. And we need to know.
And they were like, okay, fine.
Right.
So anyway, there was
some unreasonableness on the Catholic side too.
There were faults on both sides.
It's just that it was a personal thing. It wasn't a church scientific stand. It was a personal issue, in my opinion.
Yeah. And the way these stories are set up is it's always enlightened Tolly Moon trying to stand up for the ignorant populace that just wants to have as many kids as possible because this is what their religion tells them to do. And so you kind of get a feeling there's some pot shots being taken there, but which makes it seem funny that I would choose this book, but I just love these stories.
Yeah. And you know, the thing with Tolly Moon, I do love the stories too. And, you know, taking pot shots at us and stuff, but you know, she's taken, it's good for these pot shots to be thought about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because people view us as religious people that are just not going to listen to reason. Right?
Yeah.
But what we're saying is that this is reasonable. And she didn't say anything in there at all that I would have to stand up and say, you know, well, this is challenging my faith. Because, I think I really am being unreasonable here. And the only reason that, you know, there are not many things that I've come across in the Catholic Church where I would say, if I was independently looking at this in an impassionate way, that I couldn't come up with the same conclusion.
Right.
Right? There are very, very few things that I would say, you know, come from thin air. And that I just need to believe this without any other reason other than mm-hmm. it's written.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I'm talking about the ways to live and things like that.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Well, I think, too, it's – and since I went through this, as I know I've mentioned here before, when I joined the church and – or entered the church, I guess is how you say it. There were things where I suddenly went, wait, what? And I had to go and look into why do they say it? What's their reasoning? And I was like, damn it, this logic is irrefutable. If I believe these basic things, I see how they got here. And I would say that it's easy to take pot shots at any group. And this is to try to avoid the echo chamber thing where we're just hearing other people say what we like to hear. Is if you don't agree with what someone's thinking, go and at least look at their motivation for saying it and their train of thought on it, because we have to kind of be prepared for the way other people think, because in this scenario of the religion versus science or the secular way of looking at us or, you know, commenting on what we think, we have to know what they're thinking so we can be ready to go, yes, yes, but look at this. We have to know more reasons. But if you're on a side that doesn't have to think that because everybody thinks what you think, it never really hurts to at least go and look deeper into what's the logic or ask about it. Just in a, I want to know. I don't want to fight about it. I just want to know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then on the flip side, you know, people that don't believe in religion, right? Mm-hmm. And science is their religion,
mm-hmm.
because it is a replacement to some people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a false dichotomy. It doesn't, it's not neither, it's both.
Yeah, it's not competition. Yeah,
but
really.
For some people, it is either or, you know, one yeah. or the other. But they are at the whim of whatever the current thing is. You know, so they're the ones yeah. that are floating in the breeze. It's like, okay, today science tells us, you know, and these are theories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Science tells us this, and isn't it amazing? And now for the next, you know, few years, you're going to believe that. And then something comes out that refutes that.
Right.
Justly, you know, because that's how science works. You know, it's
right.
this theory is better than the previous theory. And I was like, oh, okay, now this one's it. While in the meantime, you know, we have remained stable. And,
yeah.
and often, when science comes around to something that fits so beautifully into the Christian worldview, it's just awesome. I love it. It's like, you know, here's the latest thing, and oh my gosh, you know, that kind of matches what we believe here, and isn't that amazing? But at the same time, you know, that's not the final word. Science doesn't really have a final word. You know, science is theories.
Yeah.
Science is, this is the way we think it works, and it appears to work this way, and you know, until something else comes along, that's what we have. So we know, for example, that Einstein's theory of relativity appears to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that quantum physics appears to be right. But we also mm-hmm. know that they can't both be right. You
right.
know, when you get to things that are really huge and things that are really small,
I know,
things
that's
break
what I love,
down.
Is that
yeah.
They're
so.
Both out there. Well, and that's like, we can see that even in really short-term stuff. Like, let's look at scientific teachings or findings on nutrition.
Yeah.
You know, we were all told in the, what was it, late 70s, 80s, whenever, of, oh my gosh, we better now have the food pyramid.
Yeah.
We should all be eating the Mediterranean diet with all these carbohydrates and all this stuff. Well, maybe if you're a farmer, that's super good. But now, just very recently, it's like, oh crap. You know what? That calories aren't all equal. We thought they were. We're really sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But your body processes everything differently. And or the thing about, you know, when you'd had heart attack and everything. Now, you can't eat anything with cholesterol in it. No eggs, no whatever, because cholesterol is what's bad for you. Well, dietary cholesterol is not the same as blood cholesterol. Hey, we're just really sorting that out too. And I think of my poor father-in-law who'd had heart procedures and he loved eggs so much and could have them once a week. And he had to eat oatmeal all the time. And I'm going, oh, you could have had eggs every day, buddy. You know, so if we can't even figure this out necessarily, and this fluctuates that much, how much is the bigger stuff right or wrong? And I'm not saying science is wrong.
Science
and religion go together. I like science.
Yeah. Science is not a thing that's really right or wrong. You know what I mean? It's neutral.
Yeah, it's
a process. It's a thing we do to try to figure out how things work.
Yeah.
And we work with theories. And theories are never absolutes. You know, you're not saying that. You're saying that it appears, due to our experimentation, that this is how it works, and this is the best explanation that we have for what we observe.
Well, and
that's what science is.
Yeah, for religious people, I mean, I don't understand the ones who you know, oh, that's science, blah blah blah. Because I've been listening lately, quite extensively, to the In Our Time podcasts. You know, which are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From the BBC, for anybody who doesn't know, from the BBC, and they'll get three experts and Melvin Bragg together. He is like the best.
Cool.
And they'll talk about this wildly varied set of stuff from week to week. So you may have Eleanor of Aquitaine one week, and then you have Saturn the next week, or chromatography, which I was like, holy crap, this is the neatest thing ever. I now understand so much. But I was just listening to an old one about the Earth's core and going, what? I thought it was all liquid down there. What? You're telling me it's solid at the very middle? Oh, wait. It's not the marble I'm thinking of. It's this crystal. It's like, and it's so, and here's how we understand the little we understand, and here's what we're trying to figure out. And I'm just going, not only is this cool listening to these people talk about the inventive ways they've come up with to discover this. So I'm celebrating people are great. This is wonderful. But also, what an amazing universe we live in. Who would have thought of this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me appreciate my faith and God even more. I'm just like, oh, you are the best. This is so exciting. Look what he gave us to discover.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's neat. It all goes together.
Right. And there are people that don't understand your reaction because religion is seen as just immature science.
Right? Yeah, I guess that's right.
It's an incorrect thing. You know, the thing is, you know, you can look at places in history where, you know, gods were called the cause of lightning, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in that way, you know, that was incorrect, right? You know, it was. But the thing is, that is an aspect of religion. It's not religion. It's something that people used to try to explain their surroundings, using stories, really, right?
Yeah, and it's also a false looking back at religion and how people understood things, because they make it sound like people all sat around and went, I don't know what's making that noise. It must be God. Mm-hmm. I think it's more organic than that. You know, and so that's trying to turn people into that cog in the wheel, mm-hmm. whether it's their understanding or how they fit into the environment or whatever. And it just, everything is a little more fluid than we like to think, I feel.
I think so too. Yeah. Well put.
Thank you.
Yes. And what would Tuff think?
Oh, he would say, whatever you want to think is fine. Just pay me for what I did for you.
That's right. Oh, too funny.
I have to say, I did love the aspect of it being him almost being like a used car salesman, where people are like, well, yeah, I know we said we'd pay this much, but I don't really feel like this is doing exactly the value that you said. And he's like, no problem. Have I ever shown you what happened to people who didn't go along and pay? Let me show you this video. Or, you know, I could put those things right back where I got them. Oh, no, wait, hold on.
Oh, man.
So there's that bargaining trader aspect, which I loved.
Oh, shoot. I'm just looking at some of these quotes from Tuff.
Give
so
us some.
He's getting shot at, you know.
Yeah.
And he's like, let's see, you're bluffing, said the commander at last, because he's saying, so he's getting shot at, and this is in the last story, he's getting shot at, and the guy is counting down, and Tuff starts to count with him, and he's like, wait a minute, what are you doing? So Tuff says, sir, if you must shout, you will only oblige me to adjust the volume on my communications equipment. He raised a finger. The distressing news is that the mere act of broaching the Ark's defensive shields, as I have no doubt you can easily accomplish, will trigger a small thermonuclear device that I previously secreted within the ship's cell library, thereby instantaneously destroying the very cloning materials that make the Ark unique, invaluable, and widely coveted. There was a long silence. The glowing crimson sensors beneath the darkness of Wald Ober's faceplate seemed to smolder as they stared into the screen at Tuff's blank features. You're bluffing, the commander said at last. Indeed, said Tuff, you have found me out. How foolish to think I might hoodwink a man of your perspicacity with such a blatant and juvenile deception. And now I fear you will fire upon me, rend my poor obsolete defenses, and demonstrate my lie for good and all. Permit me only a moment to make my farewells to my cats. He folded his hands neatly atop his great paunch and waited for the commander to reply. The Suthamese flotilla, his instruments avowed, was now well within range. I'll do just that, you damned abortion, Wald Ober swore. I will wait with sullen resignation, said Tuff, unmoving. You have 20 seconds, Ober said. I fear my news has confused you. The count previously stood at 3. Nonetheless, I shall take the shameless advantage of your error and savor each instant remaining to me. Yeah. It's just good. My gosh.
Yeah. Well, because he does that. He totally agrees with you, like a good salesman.
Yeah.
And then turns it back on you. So you're like, oh, crap. I mean, he has one like that for the instance I was talking about where they didn't want to pay as much as he was charging because he said he raised the bill from $2 million to $5 million. She's like, well, I had to do all this extra work. Uh-huh. Here's my itemized bill. And she's like, well, we're not going to pay. And he says, well, because of my trusting nature, I must take a loss. And they're like, as we agreed. And he says, I suppose I might accept this cruel and unethical decision and take it as one of life's hard lessons. Very well, then, so be it. He stroked Dax. It has been said that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I can only blame myself for this wretched turn of events. Why, it was only a few scant months past that I chanced to view a historical drama on this very sort of situation. It was about a sea ship such as my own that rid the small world of an annoying pest, only to have the ungrateful planetary government refuse payment. Had I been wiser, that would have taught me to demand my payment in advance. He sighed. But I was not wise, and now I must suffer. Tuff stroked Dax again and paused. Perhaps your Council of Guardians might be interested in viewing this particular tape, purely for recreational purposes. It is holographic, fully dramatized, and well acted. And moreover, it gives a fascinating insight into the workings and capabilities of a ship such as this one, highly educational. The title is Seed Ship of Hamelin. They paid him, of course.
Oh, I love it. It's so good.
Yeah. It's just, he's the iron fist in the velvet glove, I guess.
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah, he just says it all with this emotionless. Oh, mm-hmm. it's great.
And you never get the feeling he's really being unreasonable. The only place where he's really allowed a give and take with an opposite point of view is with Tully Mune or however. And I know I was reading Brian Alexander, who we know from SFF Audio. Yes. He was less than satisfied with the stories because he said that Tuff never has any growth. And I thought, well, yes, Tuff always is the same, but I don't mind that. I enjoy his character. And I think where we're seeing his value is in those conversations that he has with Tully Mune, because there, although George R. R. Martin clearly has a particular point of view, he is allowing Tully to voice the opposite point of view. She never gets to win.
Right.
And he's kind of, I don't know if I could call that unfair because, you know, Tuff gets to win. It's his story. But at least there is a certain amount of give and take in how she's considering things. So, and she doesn't even really get any growth because she has to capitulate without really changing internally.
Right. Yeah.
And she's got a lot of cats. Yeah. But she does have a lot of cats. I guess she's changed that much. She doesn't consider them vermin anymore. So.
Too great.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, and despite what we've been saying about the various things that the stories are talking about, these are so enjoyable. Do not let that stop you for 1 minute. I read them twice now and I enjoyed them both times.
Completely agree. They are such fun stories.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you for picking it.
Well, I'm glad you liked them.
Yeah, and I hadn't read these before, and it's made me remember a lot about the 80s, and it's like I'm sitting there poking around making a list of stuff that I've read and stuff that I'd like to read from the 80s, just because I want to poke around in there a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And
it made me want to go look for some more of George R. R. Martin's short stories, and I know there are several collections that I think do them chronologically. So
what's that called? Dream Songs, I think.
That's it.
And there's two volumes of that. Three volumes in audio. The three volumes of audio don't collect all of the stories that are in the two volumes of print.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're not all in the audio, but they're good. And there's two Tuff stories in there too.
Oh.
Guardians, they're not different. They're included here. Guardians and A Beast for Norn.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, those are both in the audio version.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't think he's actually written anymore. I mean,
not that I know of. Not that
if he had, I would have loved it. But
yeah, I don't think so either. But he's got some great short stories. Sand Kings is one that leaps to mind. Have you read that one?
I might have, but Sand Kings is
amazing. It's absolutely great.
Okay.
What it's about at the very beginning, this guy who just collects animals.
He really likes animals, doesn't he?
Yeah, and this story does have similarities. And he ends up taking or buying these things called Sand Kings. And they're remarkable ant-like things. And so he puts them in a terrarium in his house, and you just watch them. And they build little civilizations, like made of sand castles and things.
Okay.
But they're really smart. And, of course, it gets horrifying.
Well, naturally, otherwise.
Another one that leads to mind is A Song for Leah. Have you read that one? That's well worth seeking out. It's also has a religious overtone to it, but it's about a person that they're at a planet, and there's a religion on this planet, and it's about a human character who wants to participate in this religion to the chagrin of some other people. Okay. So
I might have read that.
It's a fairly deep religious story. And,
well, the Way of Cross and Dragon is that way.
Right.
And it's really a fascinating look at faith and commitment and action.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I don't want to say much more, but anyway.
Yep, very good. Yeah, he's going to be famous someday, this George R. R. Martin. He's going to be huge.
I think he's got a promising future.
Yeah. So
what's next for us?
Keep writing, George. Yeah, what's next? Let's see. Ostrov, The Island. This is our religious pick. It's a movie called The Island.
Okay,
Well, Ostrov is the Russian name for it.
Okay. So,
but yeah, and let's watch that.
So I'm looking forward to it.
It'll be fun.
And I've seen very few Russian movies other than things like, Night Watch.
Uh-huh.
that's more vampire situation. So I like
it. You bet. No vampires in this one.
Well, okay, fine. I'll watch it anyway.
It's almost 100% vampire free.
Oh, that almost gives me hope. Okay, I'm excited now.
All right. Well, thanks again. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you.